This is Benedict Tatatari 8-bit podcast.
Hi, I'm Kevin Savitz, and this is an interview episode of Antic, the Atari 8-bit podcast. This is a different sort of interview. I talked to three old friends reminiscing about their Atari days. These friends are Dean Whitman, Max Dierhack, and Dean Dierhack. Max and Dean are brothers. These guys were best friends, Atari pals living in the Salt Lake City, Utah area, going to Atari Computer Club meetings, cracking programs, and running a BBS. I found Dean because his name was on the title page of the video-enhanced Atari 800 by Encore that I dug out of my basement. There's a link to pictures and discussion about that machine in the show notes at ataripodcast.com. Dean was gracious enough to connect me up with Max and the other Dean for this conference call. This interview was conducted September 27, 2014 over Skype. The Skype quality isn't always the best, sometimes it's a little glitchy, but this conversation is worth it. So where is everybody? Where are y'all located?
Go ahead, Max.
I'm located in Rochester, New York.
Okay.
I am in Brentwood, California. That is Northern California.
And I'm in South Jordan, Utah.
Okay, so Dean in the middle. There's two Deans, right?
Yeah. I'm okay. Dean.
So, yeah, I'm Dean D, and he's Dean.
Okay. All right. Okay. This is going to be real confusing. Okay. So I would like you all to introduce yourselves because I don't know who you all are yet. Dean Whitman, I would like you to go first because you brought this whole party together. Tell me who you are, where you are, and a little bit about your Atari history.
Okay. My name is Dean Whitman. I'm a senior software engineer and Atari history. I grew up in Salt Lake City, Utah with the other two fellows here. And we were good friends, best friends. And we also worked in a computer company together, but we'll get into that a little bit later. And I bought my own Atari 800 when I was probably 17 or 16 or 17 years old. I think it was around that area, around that time. And just started getting into basic programming with the basic module, language and things like that. And as we'll get into the conversation later, we also started an Atari club together in Salt Lake City. And I'm now living in California instead of Lake. And just having fun, still doing the same things that I've always been doing, you know, software engineering. So I do a lot of different things now with the PC, with C# and C++ and things like that. Doing desktop applications for Windows.
Okay. All right. Who's next, Max or Dean D?
Go ahead,
Max. Which of you is the older brother?
Yeah, the older brother, not the taller one, though. Yeah, more distinguished. That looks like you got a beard, though, so that's got class.
Okay.
I'm Max Dierhack. Grew up in Salt Lake Valley. Around about time I was about 14, our family did work. We painted houses to get to the point where we could get an Atari 400. And about a year or so later, my mom ran into some money and we were able to get an Atari 800 and started with the basic programming and stuff like that. We'll probably get into the various aspects of things. Atari was a great system. I got to the point where I really knew, you know, the insides and outsides of it. Went on to get a degree in computer science and became an engineer. I've been working for the same company now for 25 years next year. Dean actually started that company, so he moved on, but I stayed behind. And I know that's about it. Oh, I'm currently currently working on a PhD in color science.
Awesome. Okay. And Dean D.
Dean D, yes.
Brother Dean.
Yes. So I'm the younger brother, Max. I'm 2.5 years than him. And we got our Atari computer in 1981. Max was the programming. He was in junior high getting programming classes, and I was still in sixth grade when we got our first computer. So I was a little punky kid running around. And we did everything Atari. You know, we did the computer club. We had the biggest BBS in the state of Utah. We had a 6 megabyte hard drive on our Atari BBS that Max wrote the software for. And then I got a job working at a software company. I actually quit day school. And got a full-time job working at the big Atari software store here in town called Software Hut. And I worked there selling Atari computers full-time. And then I was taking school at night. And then later on, you know, about 10 years later, I actually got a job working at the same company that Dean Whitman started and Max worked at. So Max and Dean and I actually worked there for, 5 years together? And then Dean left, and then I stayed there. I worked there for 16 years. I'm a product director of a software company now, and I live in Jordan, Utah.
Awesome. So you guys met in school?
No. We met in the Atari Computer Club, really.
Oh, the Atari.
Yeah, we were only one neighborhood away from each other. We were pretty close. We lived pretty close. I could go to their house. They could come over to my house, whatever.
Yeah. And Dean had the
But
car.
Dean had graduated from high school about, he was about, you were about what, 5 years older than me, Dean?
Well, I'm 52, so I don't know how old you are now.
Yeah, 4.
Okay. Yeah, so I was the older one.
Yeah. Cool. So we didn't necessarily meet in school, that's the key there. It was actually really the Atari that kind of brought us all together.
Yeah, we actually, I believe, started the Atari Club.
My first memory of Dean Whitman is going to the Atari Club, and it started out at someone's house, and everyone would bring their floppy drives, and you could plug in 4 of them on the Atari computer to copy them. We only had a cassette player, the old 320, I think it was, cassette drive, and Dean Whitman had written a cassette to disk and a disk to cassette program and a cartridge, and you took our cassettes. Games. We had this Space Invaders and some other games on cassette, and he wrote a program to convert those to floppy disk.
Yeah, I had one.
Go ahead. I was researching your name and Atari, and your name came up with with some cassette to disk utilities, which are still out there, apparently.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. That's how I first remember Dean Whitman is that.
Yeah, I was heavily into learning the internals of the Atari and how, you know, things actually worked, how things are actually started up with the cartridges and things like that. And I was also heavily into games, of course. And so a lot of these things I couldn't afford at the time, but there was copies out there already, you know, on BBSs and stuff like that. And eventually we got into a little bit of pirating. I should say a lot. And I actually got a job later on to actually do this legally, because we hired an attorney, and they told us as long as you purchase one copy of each game, and I was working for a software store there in Holiday, Utah, and they basically said, well, we want to rent, you know, time out to junior high students. And so I already had, you know, amassed a lot of games, both on, well, mainly on disc. And so they bought all the, they bought all the games that I had. So they had, you know, their own copy. And then I basically put the copies of these games onto, at the time, one of the biggest hard drives, which was the 20 megabyte Corvus hard drive. And you could store hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of these small, tiny memory footprint games on a 20 megabyte hard drive. Nowadays, 20 megabytes is, you know, the whole program is 20 megabytes.
Right.
Yeah, and I remember, Dean, they it was a network. They had an Atari network.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
they had actually rent time, right?
Yeah, they had about 12 to 16 Ataris that they would they had just laid out on different tables, and this was all connected to essentially one hard drive. And we came up with a menu system to choose, you know, which game that they wanted to play. And they just paid per hour and came in after school and you know, played games.
Wow. And this was at the Software Hut, or where was this?
No, this was a different company. I can't remember what the name of the company was, but it's no longer in business.
Computer
Plus? I don't remember.
Yeah, it might have been Computer
Plus.
Was this a company that you worked for, or that you started, or?
No, it's a company that I worked for.
They hired.
It's basically a company that sold both the Ataris at the time. Probably at that time they were also selling PCs, because it was kind of later in the Atari age. I think they were probably also selling Amigas and things like that too. But they sold software and then the time to play the games.
Hmm. Interesting. So kids would just go there after school, pay their couple bucks an hour or whatever it was, and
exactly.
Land party sort of thing.
Yep.
Well, what Dean Whitman ended up getting is a vast knowledge of how to crack these programs. And I think these two guys, Max and Dean, I think these are the two guys that actually pushed a lot of these software companies to actually start copy protection. Because when we first got into it, they weren't copy protected. You could just copy the disk. But they got more and more sophisticated, and Max and Dean would spend hours cracking these programs. Dean was doing it so that they could be put on the network at that company, and we were cracking them so that we could trade them for other programs. Yeah. You know, and we would actually have these coffee parties where everyone would come over to the house, someone would go out and buy the latest game, and they'd come to our house, everyone would show up, and we'd sit there and watch Max and or Dean crack the program 2 or 3 in the morning, and finally keep trying to crack the program. Finally they'd crack it, we'd all make copies, everyone would be happy, and he'd put it on the LAN computer.
Yeah.
And awesome. We would get the games before anybody. In a lot of cases, we would actually have connections at stores. Mm-hmm. And we'd get, in fact, the Electronic Arts, we actually got copies of their Force 4 games. It was Cities of Gold, Worms, Archon, and Mule. We got them, I don't remember where we got them. We got them before they were released. They weren't in the stores. They hadn't even put ads in the magazines yet. And these guys cracked them. Wow. And we were able to share them with everybody. We're past the statutes of limitations here, right?
Sure. But, all right. So I've talked. I know people, and I've talked to people who have pirated software, have done the copying, but I haven't talked to anybody yet who was actually doing the cracking. And I would like to know a bit about that process. I mean, is it like bootloader hacking? I mean, how? Tell me about what you remember about it.
Do you want to say something, Max?
It varied. At the very beginning, it was really bad. Really, basically, a matter of following the boot process of data on the disk. As things got more involved, one of the things that we were also involved with was we were involved with a guy named Ron Bowling, who was really responsible for doing modification of Ataris. He basically added additional RAM to them, you know, over and above the 64K that you had addressing. He was one of the first ones to come up with the idea of doing selected banks using hardware. And so he basically put double-sided tape onto the memory cards and put the memory chips, you know, upside down, bug up, and he ran wires from one place to the other and manually, with a tedious process, soldering everything. And so he basically had. And so we had a 256K Atari 8, and with that we had the ability to load the Omnimon program, which was basically kind of a what do you call that thing?
Monitor.
The monitor program that you could do it. But the cool thing about it is that we had a switch on it so that basically it wasn't it didn't show up in memory, and then we could switch it and actually enable it in memory. And actually we soft loaded it, so because it was actually a software thing, so we were able to actually load it, and then we'd flip a either switch or set of a memory variable to actually turn it into read only, and then we could basically, you know, push reset and then go right into the monitor and then look at what's going on in memory.
Yes. So there was a way that you could do it, both, you know, hardware for like copying cartridges and stuff like that. And actually Ron modified my computer too. So there's probably at least three or four computers out there that have been modified. I don't know if they still exist, but
yeah,
basically they had switches on the side, and I think we increased the memory so that whatever memory that the game took, you know, the monitor could be put into another piece of memory and it wouldn't conflict, that type of thing.
Ron's company, he was called Upgrade. What we did was is we made a modification to the operating system. We could also replace the operating system, so we could actually select it so that we could actually load the memory into the operating system, and then we could basically switch things so it was actually running off of RAM instead of the ROM. And so we could change the operating system. And in doing that, what I did was is I modified it so that the cassette interface in the operating system, I replaced that with code that would basically emulate the SIO system so that it would access the memory as if it was a physical disk. And you could we actually had a really cool system where you could boot from a disk and it would actually load up and then make the changes to the operating system, and then it would actually allow you to essentially copy a disk into the memory and run from memory as if it was a disk drive. It's really pretty cool.
A RAM disk.
It was a RAM disk, and really fast, because the Atari disk drives were horribly slow. I mean, it was a serial I/O based system, not a direct memory thing, and so it was incredibly slow. And the RAM disk was incredibly fast, but when you were actually doing things where you're trying to get something, you could actually copy all of memory into the RAM drive and then reboot, and then you could go in and actually look at the contents. We also had a system whereby we changed the way the system updated the video addresses, and so for the display list. And we basically plug in a joystick and you push a button, and then you could scroll. What it would do is it would change the video display to use a different display list that would actually it was a different display list that actually showed a screen, and then also replaced the font with a font that actually had hexadecimal values for every location. And so you could scroll up and down and look at the contents of memory real time, because it was actually being done with the video refresh. So, you know, it was really kind of cool. A program, you know, you could have a game running and you could push the button on the joystick and actually go up and down and see how memory is being modified as the game was running. And then if you
this
let
was
go
like
of
the Matrix. Joystick,
yeah, and then if you let go of the button, then it would go back to the previous display list, and you'd see the program up, you know, the game was running, and you just going back and forth, you could actually do it. And the game didn't really know that you were doing it, because the actual code was actually in the operating system and was a really small change that was being made to the code that was basically, because you actually the I/O registers were read only. No, the write only. They were write only. You could actually look at the values. And so what happened was is that Atari mapped the those registers down into locations in, I think, page 2. And in the video refresh, it would actually copy them. And so what we did was we modified the part was doing the copying, so we could actually then get different display lists and things like that running. And it was, so there's a lot of different tools you could use to actually find out what's going on in the system. And it was really made possible through basically specifically designed hardware that, extended hardware that we had access to be able to do it.
Yeah. Prior to that, before I even had my machine modified, basically, with my thirst of knowledge of just trying to learn new things, new programming languages, things like that, I learned prior to the Atari, I learned the Z80 assembly language with a Radio Shack Model 1. And then after that, when I got the Atari, I learned the 6502. And then at that time, you could also get essentially just printouts of the entire Atari operating system. And so I went in depth into the Atari operating system, learned exactly how everything worked. And once
documented their system extensively.
Yeah, they did. And so what I did was basically when I get a program, I would look at it either with Omnimon or something like that, and just essentially disassemble it. And you kind of learn patterns of what to look for, because there wasn't a lot of sophisticated copy protection software, and there was one hardware protection, which was basically on the disk. You could screw up a certain part of the disk, and if they tried to copy the disk, they couldn't copy the disk because the disk copier would try to copy everything. It's the bad sectors, it would just throw up. And so it you couldn't copy it that way. And usually what they would do is they'd have multiple sections on the floppy disk that they would put set code in between the bad sectors. And so they knew exactly which sectors the code was on and knew exactly which sectors the bad sectors were. And so they could skip over them. But a copy program would not do that, would just basically go through all the sectors. And once it hit the bad sectors, it just would stop. It would error out. So you had to figure out, I think what I did was I made my own copy program, essentially. And whenever it got an error like that, it would just say, ignore the error and go on to the next sector until you got the entire code base. It was in assembly language, or not assembly language, machine language, but then I could disassemble the program and look for patterns. The patterns were things like they would have self-modifying code. So they would have sections of code which would actually modify other sections of code and then jump to it. And so they kind of tried to hide what they were trying to do that way. And they also did things like referencing different pieces of memory through some sort of a jump table but they would jump all over the place in the programs. And it was just confusing when you were in there, but you learn these patterns and eventually everybody started adopting essentially the same type of copy protection until, somebody else came up with something new. And so for the most part, it was the same patterns over and over and over again. So, once you get 5 to 10 games under your belt, the next one that comes along, it was pretty easy to do because you would look for those patterns and immediately know exactly what to do to remove the copy protection for them.
There's a guy, an Apple II hacker who's on Twitter. He goes by 4AM, and he breaks copy protection on programs that have never been broken before. And it's a lot of educational stuff. It's, because pirates pirated all the fun games and stuff, but, not whatever, how to, there's programs for Dennis and things like that. And so he, but he breaks the copy protection, and documents everything about what he looked for and what he found and why it didn't work and how he fixed it and that sort of thing. And lately he started making videos, so you could watch him in real time, deprotect a program. And most of the videos are like 10 minutes from start to finish. He manages to do it. So that's kind of cool if you're into Apple II stuff. I'm an Atari guy, but I've never seen anything like that on the Atari side. So that's why I was asking about that.
And then Dieter Hack, he tested all the games, of course.
Yeah, right. And I organized the parties. I'd get all the guys, everyone to come over to the house. And we had a ring of people that would, you know, I was 13, 14, and I'd call these guys. These guys are in their 20s, you know, married kids. And we'd have them go. Right. They'd go to the software store, and they'd buy a copy of the latest game. And then they'd come to the house. I did all the coordinating. Okay, you buy this one, you buy that one, you buy this one. Let's come over, you know, and then the Dean and Max are going to come, and we're gonna crack the code. And we'd literally wait. I mean, we didn't have YouTube videos back then. I could have videotaped these guys, but, you know, there weren't video cameras that were really available. But we would just sit and watch these guys work and hack the code, and they'd think they'd crack it, and we would. And sometimes they weren't successful. You know, it was checking for bad sectors. They'd think they'd crack it, and it would still. And one of them formatted the disk. If it thought you were trying to crack it, it would format the game. I don't remember what game that was. I think it was that Trax game from Activision. Cool. Crazy Trax, whatever it was. Remember that train game? Anyway, and I remember on some of them, we actually had to fake it out. You could, like, it was half cracked. And at a certain point when the game was loading, you'd have to hit the break key a bunch of times to interrupt the process, and it would think that it would hit a bad sector. And then later I worked at Software Hut and selling software as these games. And what I found was the dark side of what those guys were trying to do to protect their games. We would sell legitimate copies, and sometimes the copy protection wouldn't work. You know, they'd buy a game and then it wouldn't load because it actually wasn't produced correctly. And it would think that the original copy was a cracked copy, and people would come back and want a refund. And what we would do is we'd actually give them a cracked version of it, so that they would, you know, not want their money back. Yeah. But it would also, the hard drive or the floppy drive, remember the 810 drive would go on those bad sectors. That was when it was doing that, when it was loading, and it would go. That's the copy protection right there. We knew we'd cracked it. Didn't do that anymore. And then there was the cartridges. Those were a little bit harder. Remember Miner 2049er? Mm-hmm. Sure. And that was like Bank Select, right? Mm-hmm. It was a 32K cartridge when they were only supposed to be
8K. The first one was only an 8K. The second one was actually a 32K, because it actually had all sorts of different banks. And that one was – I didn't actually really make a copy of that until way, 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 way late. And it would only work on one of our modified machines, because you had to have the ability to load things in memory and into the RAM disk memory and pull it in and do it.
It would simulate the cartridge, and we thought it was ROM. It was a hardware hack to make it work.
Yeah, actually, any cartridge that didn't do bank select was really easy, because we could just load it into memory, and then we could just basically set a register, a hardware register, that would convert it so that it would actually act as ROM, and you know, you could reboot, you could write code that would write into it, and it was as, you know, to all intents and purposes to the software, a ROM cartridge, though it had been loaded into memory. Because the way Atari architected, they only had a 64K address, and you had, you know, when you put a cartridge in, the cartridge would actually overwrite the memory that you actually the RAM, and it would actually then just run from ROM. So if you were able to load the cartridge into that RAM, and then basically tell the hardware to say, don't let anything write to that memory anymore, at that, it's effectively ROM.
Yeah, I want to just make a comment that it wasn't just myself and Max. It was actually a whole network of people.
Yeah, that's
taking down your friends with you.
Yeah. Yeah, but, you know, we were big instigators of the whole thing, too. But Max had some friends that actually flew around the country. One was, I think, a pilot.
For Eastern Airlines.
Yeah. And so he could, you know, go to different cities and actually pick up copies of programs that other people around the country actually had, you know, already cracked the code, whatever. And we go, and we would get a copy of that already. So it's not that we did all the copy protection or the copy, the whatever, the pirating. We would already get games that were, you know, already broken. So.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
Yeah, there was a whole network.
What did your parents think of this when you had, you know, all these adults and stuff coming into your house to play computers?
Well, they didn't come into my house. I think they probably came into Max Dean's house.
Our parents were patient, very, very supportive. In fact, Max and I would go over to Ron's house, the guy that was the hardware hacker. We'd be there until 3 in the morning. And
well, think about it. It wasn't always all about pirating. It was really more of the whole Atari society, you know. Copying software was part of it, but also, you know, we developed software, we modified software. I mean, one of the things I did was modify the DOS so that you could use upper and lowercase characters, and I was one of the first ones to do that.
In file names, upper and lower?
Yeah. It was Alpha DOS. Then, you know, the other thing was that we, you know, basically wrote our own. It was based on the Amos BBS. Amos, right, Bing?
Mm-hmm.
Amos.
Yep, the Amos BBS. We modified the Amos BBS so that it would work on. We ended up getting a Corvus 5 megabyte hard drive, and we wrote a system that would actually allow us to run other programs, so that basically you'd BBS, and then the BBS would actually run another program, and that you could actually run that. So we had a really complex BBS system, and when you logged in, it would use the ASCII characters and move the cursor around and draw graphics and things like that. You know, this is way before anything like the web or anything like that. So.
Yeah,
we spent a lot of time administering the BBS and having fun. We had an ELISA program where people would run their ELISA program, and, you know, they would ask, you know, how are you feeling today and whatever, you know, and they'd type things in, and then Dean could push the select key and then enter the response instead of the ELISA program, and he'd really get hooked up.
Yeah, I was playing Siri.
Nice.
30 years. In fact,
so what was the name of
Our BBS was called the Other BBS
because
at the time, these little small BBSs in town, and there was a lot of egos around running these boards. All of us had a phone line, so only one person could call in at a time. So you'd try to call that BBS, and the line would be busy. So your modem would automatically call the next BBS. And we couldn't call the name, so I said, well, why don't we just call ours the Other BBS? And so that's what it was called. And Max wrote this really elaborate system, all these programs. So you'd log into the BBS and it would come you, and then you could select a voting booth, a forum, a ELISA program. There were an adventure game, you know, a text adventure game you could do online, and it was really elaborate. And we had these movies where you'd move the characters, you know, the cursor would move around in
ASCII graphics.
And Max wrote a program to record those, and I would spend hours making these elaborate movies and putting them on our
I wrote a program to record those too.
Excellent program, and it was constantly modified. And the BBS thing was huge. And then when we got the hard drive, we had a lot of files. And the only ones we put on there were public domain. We never did any piracy on that hard drive. It's just that public domain stuff that they had. What was that magazine? Mm-hmm. You know, they had
Antic.
Yeah, all those Antic and Analog programs we had on the hard drive and let people download. But those were really good days. There was a lot of we were doing all kinds of things with the Atari. It was our whole lives back then. You know, we'd go to school. As soon as school got out, we'd go home, and, you know, we'd be on the computers. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't just the piracy. It was a lot more we did as well.
Yeah. It was a way of life, really.
It was. It really was.
Yeah, we also did a lot of consumer electronic shows. Well, not, I mean, going to them, ending them. These guys, I believe that too. But we had the whole Atari group, probably about six of us at a time, going out to Las Vegas, Nevada, staying at a place in Moapa, Nevada, which is like maybe 20 miles. I think it was east, yeah, northeast of Las Vegas. And it used to be a mansion that was owned by. Was it owned by? I can't remember.
Gary Gilmore?
No. Howard Hughes, yeah.
Howard Hughes.
And essentially, it's owned by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And because they use it for, like, young women, young men and stuff like that, overnighters and things like that. But the caretaker was one of our club members' parents. And so they were the caretakers of this property, and we would actually go out there January, the first part of January, to go to the Consumer Electronics Shows that Atari was attending, and we would just hang out a lot of time around the Atari and, you know, try to get the insights of where they were going next, what games were coming out for it. And a lot of other companies were there, you know, would actually, you know, just write software for the Atari, and we would, you know, go and visit them too. And so that was a fun time.
So I'm curious, you talked about the BBS. You said you do all this piracy stuff, but there was no pirated files on the BBS.
No.
I just want to clarify that.
Yeah.
Was there not even a secret wares section, or it was just...
No.
Why'd you have that dividing line?
You know, we didn't want to be the guys that wrote these games. We knew that if Fulton board, it would just spread like wildfire, and these companies would really be hurt. We didn't really feel like we were hurting them, you know, like we were copying games that we wouldn't have bought. So it wasn't like we were stealing money from them. But to openly, right, you know, just flood the earth with their software, we just didn't want to do that. We felt like we also didn't want to get in trouble. We felt like that file bulletin board, that might get some attention from them. There's this bulletin board in Utah that's got all of your software on it, and they'd come after us. So it was right, better just to have our underground network, you know. So we, in fact, we even had the Salt Lake Tribune, the reporter, actually, remember, he interviewed us, and he wrote an article about software piracy, and we were very, very open with him, but he only quoted us anonymously. He didn't use our names in it. You know, no one was really getting busted for software back in those days, but we just didn't want to chance it, you know, because all bulletin board was very high profile. We didn't advertise it outside of the Salt Lake Valley, but we had callers from all over the world calling long distance to call our bulletin board and be on our bulletin board. We had, it was amazing. It was all the time, because everyone that couldn't would just redial our BBS 5 seconds later, and they would just try to. So as soon as someone logged off, someone else would log back in all night long.
Yeah, we actually ended up getting a second line for the family just for the BBS.
Yeah, it was originally on our home phone. We'd say, don't call until 10:30 at night. At 10:30, and then people start calling at 10:15 and 10:05. So we finally had to get a second line.
Yeah, the parents don't like that.
Yeah.
And that time, it was a thread modem, or was it a little bit higher than that?
It was a 1200. 300. Well, it started 300.
Yeah.
It started 300. We got the Hayes 300. And then we got the Hayes 1200 after that.
Yeah, we did.
Modems were expensive. You know, the Hayes modem was like, mail order was like $150.
Yeah.
And the games that you could plug into the joystick port.
Yeah, the MPP 1000C probably was the one that
went
to the joystick port.
Yeah, we had to get the 850 interface and plug the Hayes modem into that.
Yeah.
Because there wasn't any other hardware at the time for that.
Right,
which is interesting because everything is serial.
Yeah. Right. You couldn't use the SIO, which serial. They both say serial right on them. Right. It should work. All right. I don't know if I'm jumping ahead here, but the reason I sort of found Dean was I stumbled upon this machine, this 800 that's modified for to be a video system for hotels, I guess, to display information in hotels. And it was kind of funny. So I was doing this other Atari project, and I needed a machine with four joystick ports, and on my desk I only had at the that day 800XL. So I go down to the basement, I grab an 800, which I've had for years, but apparently had never actually used, because I bring it up here and I plunk it down on the desk and I turn it on and I'm expecting to see memo pad, and all of a sudden it's this not memo pad, it's just information display. I'm going, what? I've never seen anything like this before. So I'm down this rabbit hole now, where I'm trying to do this one project, but now I have this other project. And so I started asking on the Atari forum that everyone uses, and nobody's heard of this thing. And so anyway, I figured it out, and we eventually, I'm like, there's no cartridge in here. How is it running, you know, this program? So I realized that where one of the RAM slots would be, there was this card, modified EEPROM card, which is actually right here. And here it is. And
wow.
which it didn't have. It was inside the dark computer for every, but the little windows on the EEPROMs were open, were uncovered. So like first thing I did was cover them up with tape.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, I made a ROM dump of it using, you know, binary save, and then something about the old DOS version I used, it added 3 extra bytes per sector, and so one of the brilliant people on the forum figured it out. So now for the first time ever, the program you wrote, Dean, is available on the internet.
Cool.
And you can run it in an emulator or whatever. So I'd like to know, why was that program created? How did that gig happen? And tell me about that project, please.
I think I was already graduated from high school. It was probably when I was 18, 19 years old. Mm-hmm. And I had already been teaching the Atari Club. And I knew a lot of the internals, both Matt taught, and I think Dean taught as well, in the Atari Club. But so I guess they heard of me through the other programs that I had already published through, I think it was a magazine in Texas, it was. Anyway, so they knew of me, and they knew, you know, essentially how to get a hold of me. And so I was called up one day and said, we'd like to come by your house and talk to you about, you know, writing a program for us. And I didn't know, you know, exactly what they were wanting. And so when they came out, we only spent maybe all of a couple of hours just going over what they wanted. And essentially what they wanted was a program to scroll text nice and smoothly up the screen, and basically they were going to connect it to closed circuit TVs within, essentially starting out anyway, the local hotels. Mm-hmm. And so basically a closed circuit TV hotel information system. So I already knew how to, you know, do the scrolling and things like that, but I also had to write. They wanted in hardware, like you just showed the hardware. Mm-hmm. So basically, it had to be written in assembly language, and it couldn't rely on you know, writing. Some of the memory was in ROM essentially, and we were limited to, I believe, 8K at the time. And so the program itself also had a small little text editor in there so that they could enter in the text and delete and, you know, just do the basic things that you can do with the text. Mm-hmm. And of course they wanted the time and the name of the hotel and things like just set on the screen, and then the rest of the text would scroll by it. So that's essentially what I wrote. And I did a lot of tricks in the assembly language to make it fit within the 8K. There was these things called long jumps and jumps and things like that within the assembly language. And in order to minimize both the amount of time I'd get performance through the program, and also minimize the amount of memory that it actually took, I did a lot of short jumps. And so there was not, a lot of ISRs, which were, you know, jump to subroutine type of thing like that. So it wasn't the best.
So the short jumps are the jumps that you could jump 256 bytes, I believe, right?
Exactly, yeah. And so there was a lot of that in there. So I don't know if the there's a co-author, I guess, that came and modified the application after me, and I actually have never met him. He might have, you know, modified it from there, or just added some functionality that wasn't in there in the first place. I don't think there was, I think thing in the background was colors, mm-hmm. not pictures or anything like that. Not like,
yeah, it was just color.
Yeah. And so they could change the color. And so there was two different modes, basically a running mode and an edit mode. And so you could enter in the text, and if you turned off the machine, I think it actually forgot the text. Sure, I can't remember where we saved the text at. Hmm. But it was it's essentially a text scroller, was basically all it was, with a text editor built in. And so I got probably, I'd say about 1,000 to 1,500. I worked on it for a good month and a half worth of time. And I mean, for a kid that was just starting at the University of Utah, it was actually a lot of money. So. And then.
Company's still in business.
The Ensign Communications?
Yeah, Encore Video.
Encore. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, I saw the actual. I'm running, I think it was in 1990 or 91 at the Red Lion Hotel in downtown Salt Lake City. So I knew it was still around, and, you know, 8 years after I had made it. So, but eventually I'm sure that they, you know, changed out all the machines to newer, you know, PCs and different things like that that could do the same thing with a lot more possession.
Cool.
So the other programs, if you want to know about those that I published within the magazine, one was a cartridge to disk. And so basically, since I knew, you know, how the cartridges started up, there was a jump block at the very beginning of the cartridge that would tell it exactly where to start running. And so...
Right.
It would basically copy the cartridge and then put a little assembly language bootloader in front of that when you put up the application from, or the cartridge contents from disk. It would just put it into memory where it was supposed to reside, and then run it from where you didn't have to have the cartridge actually in there. That, I mean, it's very rudimentary, but it worked. And if the cartridge needed copy protection breaking, you had to do that after the fact. So you could copy the cartridge and then break the code, and then, you know, put the bootloader on top of that and then run it. So there was some hardware protection there for the cartridges as well.
Yeah, they just stomp on the memory where the cartridge was located. ROM can't get changed, but if it was in RAM, it would just totally obliterate.
Right. Yeah.
I had one copy cart program. I don't know if it was yours, but we're supposed to start the computer with the top open,
mm-hmm.
so you could access the, but without a cart in there, and you use like mm-hmm. a Q-tip or something to defeat the interlock switch, and then it says like, okay, insert your cartridge now, yeah. and you did, and you just like prayed it didn't crash, and it always did.
Yeah,
it just always did.
That's exactly like what mine did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's all you could do, because you couldn't, if the cartridge was in there, do anything. You couldn't like boot up anything else.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think a modification to that was a cartridge to cassette as well. And so originally the cassettes were the only things, you know, available. And so I had, mm-hmm. you know, just, you know, copy the code to cassette instead of floppy disks. So I think those were the two that I had.
All right. Yeah, I know. Yeah, you had a, I think, cassette to disk and disk to cassette. Okay. I think is what I found out there.
Okay. So. It's been 30 years, so I don't know.
Yeah. No, I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just saying what I found. So, did you guys do any, the other, Max and Dean, make any programs?
Yeah, Max.
Any
Max
applications you
did?
Yeah, I wrote lots of programs. I wrote educational software. I spent a lot of time. One of the first projects I was actually paid to do was actually do a translation of genealogical software from some of their systems.
It was Adam's Apple. I think it was called Adam's Apple.
Something like that. Adam's Quest or something like
Adam's
that.
Adam's Quest or something like that, yeah.
Yeah, it was like on a Commodore PET or something like that. So I did a port of that. I also did a port of lots of other educational software. So we wrote a software package for a snow cone company to keep track of their business and stuff like that.
It was a full accounting package.
It was a full accounting package, and it was cool. We spent a lot of time getting the little rain, because the name of the company was called Rainbow Shack, and so we spent a good time was getting a display list rainbow on the top of the screen so that you could see a rainbow as you were doing everything. But you had to be careful to turn the rainbow off whenever you did IO, or otherwise it would crash the computer. And let's see. Those are the big things. What else did I do?
Did you publish anything in magazines like that?
I don't remember really doing anything like that. I mean, the big things I did really were basically modifications of the operating system for Ron's company. Basically, whenever he did an upgrade on a computer, he provided them a software IPAM that basically implemented the RAM disk system that they used. So that's right. And he gave me a portion of every one of the systems created. So that was ongoing revenue I ended up getting.
You also spent a lot on all that BBS stuff, and I don't think we ever gave that to anybody. All those programs, did we give them
them
back?
One other person, Paul Griffin.
Oh, that's right. Paul Griffin used our BBS system.
He used our BBS system. So a lot of the stuff that we, that I developed was not necessarily something that I, published or gave to other people.
So do you still have that stuff?
It's in my closet. I haven't actually fired it for years, but I still have it. We could probably get the other BBS up and running.
Oh yeah,
Another thing. Okay, another thing I do besides these interviews is, as I'm working with archive.org, and I'm trying to get all the everything for Atari out there. And I'm especially looking for, all the games have been pirated and applications, that's all done. But looking for source code, I'm looking for stuff that hasn't been released in the wild yet. And trying to encourage people to share it. And if you are willing to do that, if you want to let me borrow the disks, I can easily move them to modern media and rescue it all before those disks.
Well, the thing
run
is,
away.
BBS doesn't exist on disks. It exists on the actual mort, or hard drive. We call them mort, and that's where everything lives, is on mort. So the real key would be whether I could actually fire up mort and have him actually work. That would be an interesting thing to do, because I got to the point. I mean, I was really into changing things. I actually got to the point where I ported the Corvus. Operate the Corvus runtime, because what happened with the Corvus hard drive is it basically loaded a chunk into memory and extended the used memory. And so if you wanted to run games and stuff on top of the Corvus operating system, it had memory, and so some things wouldn't work. But what I did was I basically took all that code and moved it up into the cassette area, and actually had it so that I could actually talk to the hard drive as if they were floppy disks, and so you could boot off of the Corvus and run. So that was an internal kind of thing, but basically I had a really elaborate system where I could basically know, I boot up my disk, and then it would load stuff into my computer, and then from point on, then I could actually get things off of, because the way the Corvus worked is it actually separated itself into, you know, simulated floppy drives, and you could potentially select which ones you want to do and run from that. But I could do that in the operating system, and that's really what the other BBS was top of. And so it's kind of a system that kind of requires that custom hardware too as well.
Cool. So Dean and Dean, do you still have Atari machines?
No, Max got all the Atari stuff.
No, I don't have anything anymore.
I do have the emulator on my PC, and I have all the software had on that. So I have two daughters, and they all Atari very well. We play Mule from time to time with the emulator, and I upload my old discs and stuff I did in school. So I still am an Atari fan, even though I don't actually have any physical hardware. Manned up with all of our hardware. He's got a whole room of stuff. He's got the hard drive, the multiple Atari computers, all of it.
But, wow. Yeah. I think I sold mine in a garage sale, mm-hmm. along with all the floppy disks. I probably had 300 to 500 different floppy disks, so all that stuff kind of went with it.
Yeah.
Now I still have our Atari 800, the Ron upgraded version, and then I had an 800 and a 13 XE. We also had the 130 XE upgraded. 130 actually, it actually had like 64K extra, and Ron actually also upgraded that, so you get 256K, and we set up a RAM disk for that too as well. Actually, it was interesting because Ron, he had this really cool system for doing upgrades, and one went down to Atari, and he went to the engineers and showed them that, you know, that he could get, you know, quarter megabyte of memory in one Atari bit, you know, and they were looking at him, you know, and scratching their heads and saying, "You can't do this," and you know, he's trying to sell it to them, and they didn't necessarily buy him, so they actually ended up doing their own little thing, which really made Ron unhappy. But I think that some of the stuff that they 130 was actually inspired by what Ron Bowling.
Absolutely, because he met with the actual hardware gurus of Atari and showed them his modifications, and then the 130XE came out, and he felt like that was sort of
he actually modified the 800 to have extra memory in it,
right?
And then they came out with the 130 that did something very similar to, because what Ron did was essentially what they did was since you only had the two ports, you had the extra bits on the PIA still floating around there, so hooked those up into memory chunks and allows you to basically chunk the memory. But he did it slightly different, and so when they did it, they at least copied what Ron Bowling had set up.
Wow.
Yeah, I remember spending a couple of nights with Ron as he was upgrading, you know, my Atari 800, and we basically I think you were the first one. And then he did mine, but basically he would work all night long, just never stop drinking coffee,
and Pepsi.
Yeah, Pepsi, and we would just
couldn't go wrong getting a Pepsi.
And that, I mean, it was fun times, but we were just so tired the next day, and then we would just do it until it was finished. I mean, he did all the work. We were just there basically to, you know, give him company and just talk to him.
He had these big, huge maps where he did out the schematics of how to do it. And then he'd spend hours, you know, he'd put the chips on there and put the memory chips. And the memory was extremely expensive, too.
Oh, yeah.
It was, yeah, you know, to get, you know, 64 or 256K of memory, you know, was just super expensive. And then he'd put the logic chips in there, and he'd do this on top of a memory. You'd have your existing memory board, you'd put a disk on top of it, and then it all wired together. You have this beautiful mass of red and green wire that you plug in, and then that would actually, and then he'd modify, you know, put the switches, and we also had this little LED, because the thing about it is there was a memory location that would control what was going on, and so whenever we wrote to that memory, we could actually see it. So he could actually see, like, what parts of the operating system were protected, what parts of the memory were protected, and whether or not, you know, what was going on there, and you could, so you could actually see how your system was configured by the LED.
Incredible. Okay, what haven't we talked about yet that we need to talk about?
I just wanted to show this.
Uh-huh. I've got a t-shirt here. It says Atari Computer Enthusiast. Enthusiast is spelled wrong. How many of these shirts did you have printed up?
I think we have like about 50 to 100 or something like that.
Yeah.
And we went with it because, you know, it's a collector's item now, and there's the front of it.
Mm-hmm.
There's
Computerize Utah.
And so basically we have a cutout piece of a floppy disk, mm-hmm, shape of Utah.
Oh, I see. Yeah, it's a floppy disk with the top corner cut out, so it's shaped like Utah.
Right.
Also looks like you kind of maybe did that with Print Shop.
Probably.
I'm going to get a screenshot of that. Hold that up again. Let me get a screenshot.
Okay.
Yeah, the person put the t-shirts together couldn't spell, and when it was pointed out at the meeting, it's like, duh, you just spelled it wrong. But, you know, from that point on, we were all enthusiastic.
this doesn't fit me anymore.
Oh, no.
Sorry.
You know, the Atari Club, by 1985, it was the largest club in Utah. We had over 800 members, and we would fill an auditorium of a junior high. And I remember when they first started, it was just in somebody's living room.
Yeah.
There were a lot of Atari computers. Ataris were huge here in Utah, large install base. There was at one point like four or five different square stores around town that sold Atari software. And then the, uh-huh, you know, PCs came in. The Apples were, you know, they were there, but only the Ripple had Apples, you know, and Atari was really the computer for the masses at that time. And then there was some Commodore 64 people, but they always stayed small. But we had a huge presence here. I think part of it's, you know, we felt a lot of pride because the guy that started Atari, he went to the University of Utah, and he worked at the amusement park here in Utah, and he worked in the arcade of Lagoon.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of where he got the idea to have a, you know, Pong. I mean, he didn't do Pong when he was there, but he got the idea because he worked in an arcade, and he had this idea to create arcade games, stuff that he was learning at the University, mm-hmm, of Utah. So we always felt really kind of close to the roots of Atari here in Utah. We had a huge presence here.
Yeah. Yeah, we started the Atari Club out of one of the stores downtown.
That's right. That's right.
What was it called? Software, something like that. But anyway.
It was where we got ours. Richard Block owned it.
Yeah. So there was a couple of Atari stores. One was the Software Hut, and the other one was a slightly larger store, but they didn't do as good as Software Hut, I don't think. And we started that up, and we had weekly meetings. I think it was weekly.
No, it was monthly. It was monthly meetings. Yeah, we have the meetings afterwards. We go to Arby.
Yeah. And then we moved over to junior high, and we, mm-hmm, we did that in the classrooms and then also in the auditorium. And then we also moved to, I believe, an arcade that was on 39th South.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And it used to be a, I think it was a Ford dealership. And then they moved out. And a company, or Atari Club members, actually worked there. And so we would have, it was kind of interesting because we would have a shorter a meeting because we knew that we were in an arcade. We wanted to play games. And the
at the Ford dealership, they were probably longer.
Yeah. I mean, there were many games there, and you know, they were from not just Atari, but they, you know, just different kinds of games. But they were, you know, the stand-up games, the things you put quarters in for. At the time, it might have been nickels, but I don't know. But the guy that worked there, you know, he had access to all the game machines. So he would just, you know, open up a little door in back and rack up, you know, 20 credits or whatever and let us play for free. It was really a fun time. Yeah, I believe that same person carried on a lot of the Atari club after that. Because I kind of fell out of it because I was getting older, going to the University of Utah, trying to, you know, get my career up and running. I actually started because of what I did in the Atari club. I was an instructor in the Atari club. And one of the managers from Unisys, which was a local company there, needed a program assistant. So he
needed a what?
A programmer's assistant, they called it at the time. And basically, it's a person that just helps other programmers do whatever odd jobs that they didn't want to do. So he was a computer enthusiast, and he came out to our Atari club one time, and I was teaching, and he said, you know, I'm looking for somebody. Would you like to come in and interview for this job? And I said, sure. You know, and that's essentially where my software engineering programming got started as far as professionally. And so I did get the job and worked for Unisys for several years, and then on from there. From that, so I have to, you know, credit Atari for giving me my career for that.
Awesome.
So one other thing that, well, actually, now this doesn't have anything to do with it, but all three of us worked at a company called Onyx Graphics. I think Max still works there. And so I was the first one there. I was a co-founder of the company. It's still a company in Salt Lake. And what they do is they write printer software to basically drive wide format printers and also software that allows people to, well, you know, I left around, I think it was 2001, so I don't know exactly what they did afterwards, but they've added server software and different things like that. So, you know, we have a long time friendship, working together, playing together, and it's been a really cool friendship.
It's great that you guys still keep in contact after all this time. Yeah.
So I wish I had my Atari, but I don't.
You're gonna have to take it from my cold dead fingers. I got it. I understood. I've never since then. You know, the Atari was simple enough that you could completely understand it. You know, you could completely understand every aspect of the operating system. You completely understand every aspect of the heart. You know, I did actually begin a project of right Atari emulator. I never too far into it, but because I thought that was a kind of a cool thing to do. But that, you know, since then, you know, I've learned various and sundry things, but I've never been as quite as familiar with anything else as was with the Atari system.
Yeah, I think there's something very unique about Max and Dean's generation, my generation. Both of these guys knew assembly language. They could like read it like they were reading, and that's helped both of the careers. And, you know, I work at a software company still, and I work with software engineers. In my opinion, they're not as good as they, you know, they don't understand code guys do, and these guys can write in assembly fluently. You guys probably dream in assembly.
I don't know about that, but
Dean was better at writing. I didn't necessarily do a lot of writing assembly, but I got to the point where I could read it. You know, and totally and understand sure. it.
Yeah.
And that's really the key there is that you you really could. You really had to be in assembly to get the performance too. You know, I mean, yeah. Basic and stuff like that were okay. Let's see, Action did a reasonably good Jinxons, but really, basically, if you really wanted to get stuff, you really needed to do things in assembly.
Yeah,
and that helped both of you guys in your careers moving forward, learning other languages and under. I mean, you with you know, the printers, Dean, and writing those drivers and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was another company I worked for right after Unisys, which you know, I had to use assembly language too, but it was 68,010 assembly language, and we did everything in assembly language. It was the operating system, the applications, everything. And this, that led up to basically C language and C++ and things like that. But yeah, it's helped me a lot in knowing exactly down to the hardware level, essentially, you know, what was going on with drivers and things like that. So yeah, a lot of what I did at Onyx was, you know, writing the printer drivers. And we didn't have to do it in assembly language, but essentially at that point in time, I think it was still DOS and extended DOS. And then eventually we got into Windows, and I think there's an operating system in there that I can't remember what it's called, but Max did some work on that too. And so anyway, yeah, the assembly language really got you into the internals of the Atari. And I think because you knew 6502, you could all move over to Commodore 64 and different things like that, because they were, you know, using the same processors essentially.
Same with the Apple II.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think with the Atari, was a significant difference with the Atari though was, there's also the aspect of the hardware, the graphics, the Antic chip, and that, you know, the display stuff was so advanced. A lot of what you did was really the hardware itself, and not necessarily the software. You know, I mean, the scrolling, the program you did, most of it was really basically putting something in, and then changesters in the hardware, and so getting a very good understanding of how the intricacies of the hardware itself was incredibly important. You know, I don't think that you know, developers now get anywhere the level of the hardware that you had to be when with the Atari, because really, basically, to do games or to do anything, it was a mixture of, you know, assembly language and configuring and using the hardware to do whatever you needed to do, and you know, there was some complicated aspects to the, but the interfaces to it were rather simple, and so it made it made things, you know, like, you know, player missiles and all that fun stuff. That was really what the hardware did, where, you know, you didn't actually have to think of terms of software, just basically stored some things in some memory locations and check some other memory location, and you could move things around, see if you got collisions, all that fun stuff. Whereas, you know, in modern day stuff, it has to be done everything in software.
Right.
Atari system is still an incredibly wonderful system.
I agree.
What were your favorite games?
The one I still play when I boot up my emulator is Mule.
Mule.
Yeah.
I think I liked.
Yeah, I played hours of Mule with my dad. Hours of that and Jumpman.
And Jumpman, yeah.
Jumpman and the Diamond game.
Oh, Emerald Mine.
Boulder Dash.
Oh, Boulder Dash. Boulder Dash. Yes.
Boulder Dash.
Boulder Dash, yes.
Now, Boulder Dash, that was a fun game to look at the memory thing, where you could actually see what was going on in memory while the game was playing. Because you had this big, right? You could only see a portion of it. It actually ended up being like a 40-character screen, and so you could actually see the whole screen while you were playing it by scrolling through memory and getting it to the line just right.
Yeah, I think I remember.
You're a cheater, sir.
I think I remember a game called Necromancer, and that was a really cool game too. Dig Dug, I think there was Miner 2049er. And Joust.
Actually, one game we played the most in terms of group games would be Mule and Alibaba.
Alibaba and the 40 Thieves. Yeah, because we used all four joysticks. You could have four people, and I think a fifth one on a keyboard. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. I don't think I played that one, at least not with that many people.
It was an adventure game. Fun. It was just some dragons, and you'd move your character in steps, and you'd have trolls or wizards, and it was basically Dungeons and Dragons on the computer.
Multi-screened. It was a fun game.
Yeah, you get treasure and have knives and fight.
Hours on that one trying to solve that one.
So you know of a place does like the Atari podcast. Does it have a place where you can like download Atari emulators and Atari games and actually play them?
So the Atari podcast site, you know, we just basically use that to link to everything we talk about. But there are several other sites that do a really good job with rounding up emulators. There's basically one for the Mac right now, and there's a couple of good ones for Windows, as I understand. The AtariAge.com is kind of the forum that everyone uses to talk about Atari stuff. And that's a great forum. What was the question?
I was just wondering if there was... it sounds like Atari Age is the website to go to...
Yeah, that's a place to start. Yeah,
okay. I've just been in it
There's
for a while.
There's news on the front page, and then, you know, it's a small but active community of people. So there's now three Atari podcasts. Which just baffles me. We've been doing ours, like I said, for about a year and a quarter now. And in the last two or three months, two other ones have popped up. One is dedicated to, he's going through the Atari magazines chronologically. And he's like, now it's January 1980. Here's what happened this month. And he goes to magazines
and... That's great. That's great.
Yeah. So it's, you know, it's one magazine per issue. And, through episode, and then he reviews one program that came out in that time. So and he plays it. And the other podcast is only, it's really new. It's only applications. So he's going through his season one is word processors. So he's doing all the Atari word processors in the order they came out, talking about their features and, you know, if they're usable and rating them, that sort of thing. And then our podcast, Antic, is more of, we talk about news, we do the interviews. It's more of a general, you know, Atari 8-bit thing with, you know, news and features and that sort of stuff. So, yeah.
Cool.
So you talk to people who are still using Atari 8 to do interesting things?
Yes. Yeah. I tend to interview old timers, and Randy tends to interview current people who are doing things. And yeah, I just listened to an interview that he did. There's a guy who's developing a GUI for the Atari 8-bit machines, and it is with the mouse, and it looks like old time Mac, you know, with one color screen and. He's developed this GUI. And there's people, guys who are doing hardware, you know, add a megabyte of RAM to your Atari or a flash cartridge. I got one around here somewhere that, you know, you put a compact flash thing into it and then the Atari sees it as a giant hard drive or
thousand
floppy disks or whatever. Yeah.
That's great.
And just plug in a cartridge and it works. There's this magical thing out of Poland, which I don't think it's all that new, really. I can't tell. I'm detached right now. It's called an SIO2SD. And you put an SD card in there and it thinks it's a floppy drive. And so you can just, you know, download software from your Mac or PC, put it on the SD card, walk it over to the Atari, plug it in. It's like, okay, let's play Alibaba now or whatever it is. yeah. Which is what I use to, I go the other way to archive stuff off of disks. I copy them to the SD card and then I can upload them to archive.org or whatever. So if you want to get back into playing with Atari, there's plenty of ways to do it.
That's great. That's great. It looked like 10 years ago there was a huge wave and then it sort of died out. But it's great to know that you guys are still doing stuff with Atari. That's awesome.
You could start up,
it's a lot of fun.
Dean, you could start up a bulletin board on the web or something like that.
There you go. Yeah.
There are a few. There are maybe three or four. And you can access them through Telnet or through some magic. I guess you can actually do it through your actual hardware. You know, and at that point, you've got like SIO getting somehow to USB to serial to... into a real modern computer, you know, with a TCP/IP stack. I haven't tried that, but it's apparently it's doable if you want to invest the time.
That would be a lot of time.
All right. Anything else we need to talk about before we close up shop?
I don't have anything else.
No.
No. That covers it.
It's our important, happy part of our lives.
Yep.
Yeah. Thank you guys so much for taking the time to talk to me today.
Well, thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, great reminiscing. Thanks.
Yep.
Great. Talk to you later.
Thanks, guys.
Bye. Bye.